And I am surprised that enough of you, or so many of you, wanted to spend a little time thinking about cities and where we are. I suppose that there's a sense in which we take whatever we are down at the bottom of the mountain up here with us. But, you know, after 10 days up here, it's not an easy task for me to get my head back in Chicago. I was helped yesterday by the presence of the jackhammer over at the jacuzzi. I don't know if I would have been able to make any notes at all on this morning's presentation if they hadn't decided to tear that thing up. So
have you tried running behind the bus, George?
Yes, right. That was my next exercise. Maybe I'll do that to get tomorrow's notes together. I thought about a number of different ways. We've got a couple of mornings to spend on the question of cities and where we are and where we're going. And I thought about pulling out some of the stuff that I've used in the past that is rather more tightly organized and well thought through. And then I thought, no, this is really the ethos up here is a kind of discursive ethos. I mean, people want to talk some and think rather kinds of scattered thoughts. And I have no trouble approaching cities in that way. I find cities infinitely stimulating. And sometimes when you come into contact with stuff that is infinitely stimulating, you find your head going in all kinds of different directions. So that's what I want to do this morning, go in all kinds of different directions, and maybe seed some particular directions in which we want to take it further. Both in discussion later on this morning and as we, those of you who want to come back tomorrow morning, think a little bit more about the question of the future of cities and what an agenda for those of us who work in or on cities might be thinking about doing with the next decade. I think it's probably fair to describe a little bit of what I do in Chicago, just to give you some small handles on what I have to say about cities. Some 10 years ago, a couple of us who were doing some organizing in Chicago, community organizing and other kinds of organizing, and that was Vietnam days and working on that too, found ourselves in a position of bringing college-aged people into the city, at that point mostly to help on organizing tasks and to think a little bit about the relationship of political and economic questions in first world cities to the kinds of political and economic questions involved in our military ventures in Vietnam, that kind of linkage between foreign policy, politics, and urban politics at the time of the height of the movement for liberation in the black community seemed to us an important linkage to make. So we were working with some college students on doing that. One of the things that I was struck with, having spent some time in the academy previous to that, was how the city operated on college-age people as a kind of can opener to simply, mixing metaphors shamelessly, peel away layers of self-deception, layers of unclear notions, I suppose, about how things really worked. In other words, something happened when you brought college students used to the academy and the cornfields into direct contact with a variety of inputs and people in the city that was very exciting pedagogically. And we thought, when we heard that there was a consortium of colleges interested in an urban studies program, that we had a handle on what one ought to be, and that it had two major components which the colleges would probably balk at. We won on both scores. One argument that we had with our constituent colleges was, should we have an independent faculty? We argued very strongly that we should have. that anybody teaching in this kind of a situation, if you want to take the city seriously, you have to have the city as your priority and not some campus or academic department. So we now have a faculty of 10, and our priority is not some campus, Grinnell, Carleton, St. Olaf, McAllister, whatever, but our priority is our involvement, continuing involvement in the city. That was very important. We won that, and we have that kind of a faculty at this point. Our second major requirement of the colleges, if we were to participate in this venture, was that an urban studies program needs to be encounter and experience based. That is, that you do not replicate political science, economics, sociology, literature, whatever kinds of classrooms out of Carleton or St. Olaf, and you put them in the city and you call it an urban studies program. No. That somehow the task of something like an urban studies program, if it was to be a lively kind of thing, the task was to bring students smack up against people in the city. And to make sure that as much as possible, the city could act as the teacher of these students. Well, that's what we've been up to for the last 10 years. When we started it, it looked to me anyway, like it might be a 3-month gig and some way to you know, pay the bills while I was doing organizing in the community there, while waiting for the next thing to come along. And here we are 10 years later, having survived various kinds of shifts in ethos, both on the campus and in the city. And it's still a very exciting setting in which to teach. What we try to do is to take advantage of whatever is going on in the city at a given time and uncover it, reveal it, probe it as much as we possibly can with the group of 90 or so students that we have in for a 4-month period. They live in communities, they encounter street life. We look at topics through the actors who do those topics. When we're looking at city politics, we're looking at, therefore we're meeting with aldermen, mayors, organizers who won't touch electoral politics, representatives out of the black community, the Latino community, various ethnic constituencies, and so on. And that way, the student is forced to begin to try to make sense of that for him or herself. Our major goal, one of our major goals, is to somehow engender in the sort of privatistic mindset that students come to us to try to make some space for a sense of public duty, a sense of citizenship, a sense that they can affect stuff, a sense that they can be change agents, that kind of business. And to a great extent, that has happened. One of the joys of working in our kind of setting for this period of time is to watch the students who have gone through the program both go back to their St. Olaf's and shake things up, and then later come back into the city, some 300 or 400 probably now in Chicago, and do some of the most interesting things going on in that town and form for us a kind of network of contacts and fellow probers and a network that's even mobilizable around certain city issues when we want to get them involved in stuff. So it's a fun kind of setting to teach in. I would have a lot of trouble going back into the academy at this point after having done this. One of the both advantages and limitations of teaching in our kind of scene is that we are, I suppose, even more than cross-disciplinary in our approach to city life. We are, by some lights, non-disciplinary. That is, the city does not appear to us as a series of academic categories that fall neatly into departmental holes on campus, but it appears to us as a kind of an intermeshed, complexly intermeshed web of stuff. And you know, you can't possibly deal with politics in the city without knowing something about community and ethnic groups and economics and culture. So very often we simply ignore academic disciplines, or we bring them in after the experience of the integrated whole of the city as possible helps. But we certainly don't start from a disciplinary kind of framework. So, those of you who are economists, political scientists, sociologists, our faculty, many of us having been trained in academic disciplines, has both been forced to and been delighted to leave our academic disciplines behind. Okay, that's kind of what we do. One of the things we find it helpful to do with students at some point, usually after some impact that the city has made on them, not immediately, is to try to step back a little bit and think about what we mean by city and how what we mean by city has shifted radically, really, in the 20th century, and continues to shift radically. I want to do a couple of things this morning. One, just think out loud for a little bit about some of the questions around the meaning of city historically, and then second, get into five or so of the possible 50 particular crisis areas in the city. Try to update us on what's been going on for the last 15 years and where I think the major questions and problem areas are that remain still unsolved on our agenda as we think about the future. You all know that cities are not new things, that we're talking about some kind of a social organism that goes back 5,000 years to the first gathering around agricultural needs in the Mesopotamia area, that our thinking about city these days really goes back at least to the to classical Roman literature. The Latin root urbs is related to the Latin word orbis, or circle. So that the original way to think about cities was as a circumscribed geographic area which was crossable by foot or animal within a prescribed period of time, usually about 45 minutes, so that you could, in the ancient world, talk about cities as basically circles with about a 3-mile diameter, and that anything out of that circle was not urbs, of course, that was pre-suburbs. So there was a clear distinction between what people meant by city and what people meant by rural. That isn't so easy anymore, obviously. In my own way of thinking about cities, I guess I think that it's more helpful to deal not with the boundaries, now more or less seen as arbitrary, which define cities, but to think rather about the sense in which we are absolutely and completely a metropolitan civilization, even Holden Village. There is not much that we do consume, wear, eat, talk about, think about, that is not framed by a metropolitan sense of reality. So that it's important in our kind of civilization to, I think, to begin to get away from the notion that there is anymore a clear distinction between rural and urban. It's certainly possible in census terms and so on to think about metropolitan regions, but the more I talk to the farm people around in the village these days and other folks, the clearer it becomes that you can't even think about agriculture as a non-metropolitan endeavor these days. All you need is a day at the Board of Trade in Chicago to look at and see in motion and all these wild hand signals and stuff. You've seen the way the Board of Trade, maybe on film or something, operates. It's a very primitive looking kind of scene with people shouting and waving their hands and stuff. But what goes on there is that the agriculture of the Western world is coordinated. And that is now an urban task, to coordinate the agriculture the capitalist world, at least, and to some degree parts of the socialist world. The city, I think, can be to some degree approached as the place where extremes define reality. There's something eternally elitist about cities. As philosophers and theologians have thought about cities through the ages, you find them absolutely polarized. There's really not too much middle ground from between the city of God, thinking about the good city in various philosophical traditions, on the one hand, and the city as Sodom and Gomorrah and Babylon, the place of idolatry. Those of you who know the works of Jacques Ellul recognize that kind of strain that has come down to us clearly out of Old Testament sources. So that the city is either seen as a place of depravity or a place of high culture, glory, achievement, a center for science, a center for government, the best that humankind is capable of doing and achieving. There's a sense in which cities are still like that, and in fact contain in them today only extremes. Get back to that in just a second. It may be demographically, for instance, that in most American cities, until very recently, we saw a kind of polarization, the city becoming a place for the very young, single or childless couples, and the very old. The city as a place for only the very rich or the very poor. The kind of stable middle ground, middle age, productive years, a kind of population has been steadily leaving the city. That's part of the demographics that we deal with in contemporary American cities. There are two huge phases that American cities have gone through in the last few years, in the last 50 years, that we've got to be aware of because we're beyond them. The first, obviously, being the major receptacle for immigration, both from abroad and internally, particularly blacks from the South, more lately Latinos from various cultures, and then obviously the post-World War II government-seated move to suburbanization. All of those have effects that we'll talk about when we get into the issue part of the morning. Just a few stats that you ought to be aware of in terms of just thinking about metropolitan regions and how they have grabbed us and sucked us in as a people. All you have to do is read a little Jefferson and some of the other founding folks to recognize that we were founded as basically an anti-urban, at least a non-urban, and maybe an anti-urban nation. In 1790, we had only 5.1% people in urban areas. By 1890, that had, with the advent of industrialization and the industrial city phase of city history, that had gone up to about 35%. By 1940, with the continued expansion of the industrial city, we're up to 56% urban population in the U.S., and in 60, it's up to 63, 70, around 70%, and still rising. Those are percentages basically out of the SMSA, the Standard Metropolitan Statistical Areas, which the census uses as the definition in counting population and dividing them into urban and rural. Basically, they're talking there about metropolitan areas of over 250,000 inhabitants. Historically, the growth of urbanism has been equated, at least in American life, with the growth in progress. the two notions are inextricably intertwined in American thinking. Clearly, the expansion of industrialism and the shift to an industrial economy depended upon the growth of cities. You can't think about an industrial civilization without thinking about an urban civilization. So cities really are the place where all of our notions about progress and growth as the good are defined. How can we think about defining cities? What are the characteristics that we think about when we think about urbanism? Lots of different definitions have been given. There are at least three characteristics which I think are key. One, clearly, compactness. Two, and this is a little bit more problematic, but I think it goes to the heart of what the character of a city is like, something about an intensity of public life. And this may be a problematic area at this point in American cities, and we might want to come back to it. That there's something about a citizen of a city that involves him or her in absolutely inevitably in a public dimension. And that the sense in which people are not, cannot exist in cities as atomized individuals means that your sense of private life as somehow exclusive of the polis or the polity is diminished. And third, clearly, we're talking about some kind of an intense mix of all types of human activity in close proximity. So those three kinds of definitions, I think, hold true for what I want to mean by urbanism: compactness, the intensity of public life, and the interaction of all kinds of human activity in a close proximity. Now, if you begin to unpack those are very, very pregnant definitions, and each could be spun out at some length. Some things have happened in the growth of American cities as the metropolitan regions have expanded. If we think about the expansion of cities in the post-World War II era, suburbanization, the growth of sprawl, the birth of the talk about urban corridors now, even beyond metropolitan areas, some things have clearly happened that we can pinpoint. Not only has the population in the area grown, covered by urban characterized lives grown, but increasingly the growth of cities has meant a segmentation of lives. That is, work and living have been almost inevitably separated. You very seldom anymore see in metropolitan regions residential areas which are also areas that produce work and jobs. So one of the consequences of, and this was not always true in cities, you know, in the first stages of the industrialized city, work and job were very often very close, and it's only with the growth, obviously, of the automobile and transportation networks that the separation of work life and residential patterns has really come to characterize modern metropolitan America, and in fact all of the advanced metropolitan world. Along with that has come what we now consider to be a fait accompli, but which is really a factor that's fairly new in cities, and that is the separation of races and classes within metropolitan areas. It used to be, obviously, in cities that poor people, most often in the service of wealthier folk, would live in close proximity to the people that they serve. It's a fairly recent phenomenon, to some degree based on the development of a mass consumption culture that has meant that status is now defined by separate neighborhoods, and that you can clearly delineate the class status of a neighborhood simply by looking around where you are. This is pretty new. In other words, slums are fairly new in cities. Areas that are entirely poor, entirely black, not that old a factor in cities, and I think a direct result of the very complex processes of industrialization and metropolitanization that we're talking about. One other way to think about cities historically, and then we'll get into what's going on now, meteor stuff that we know something about. If you think about three basic stages in the functions of cities in cultures, one of the amazing things is that they are changing so rapidly, given their steady function over thousands of years. For something like 5,000 years, cities were basically the seat for the service elite, for government, for culture. This is the vision that we get out of the Greeks talking about cities. It's to some degree the market function of cities that we see in the Old Testament, in the ancient world, was secondary to the to the function of cities as the places where the kings and rulers lived and where the service elite made their headquarters. Well, lots has changed. Lots of things have changed since in the last century. We went through probably close to a century, from 1850 to 1950, maybe a little shorter than that, in which the dominant form of Western cities, including American cities, was some kind of industrial city. That is, the reason cities grew was that the American economy, for instance, was shifting to an industrial base, and that in order to build factories and to manufacture goods, one needed to concentrate on urbanization. And the face of cities today is still influenced by their phase as industrial organizations. I would contend, I think, that we're into a different phase now, that even though Gary still looks like Gary, and you know, Richmond, California still looks like an extension of Standard Oil or whatever the oil companies are down there, that we're into something else now, and that cities do serve or are beginning largely to serve a much different kind of function. And I guess the easiest way for me to talk about that is as a mass service function, that somehow we are shifting from cities as industrial cities to mass service cities. If you think about the, and we may talk about this a little bit in a minute, the structure of jobs in the city, it's clear that the kinds of jobs that cities are losing, part of what we call the urban crisis, at huge rates are the industrial and manufacturing jobs. Partly they're going to suburbs in the Sun Belt, but partly they are simply being eliminated. There are fewer and fewer jobs in the production of goods. We talked last week about Daniel Bell's prediction that by the year 2000, only 3% of the population will be needed to manufacture all of the goods that the society needs. Only 3%. That leaves 97% of us dealing in some segment of the service economy. Economies produce goods and services. Cities used to produce goods. Increasingly, they produce services. And that has meant a huge change in character in our urban landscape. As a matter of fact, if you look at towns, for instance, like Cleveland, which has lost most of its industrial base, what you see and what you hear from the business elite in that city is a recognition that if Cleveland is to be rebirthed, or even to some degree Detroit, what you have to do is to just forget about industrial jobs and expansion of the industrial sector, but you have to concentrate instead on the growth of the huge service bureaucracies, both public and private, so that downtowns in cities now become the place not for heavy industry, manufacturing, the center for transportation, for the shipment of goods, but instead they become the place for the housing in huge boxy skyscrapers of the provision of services, everything from banks and insurance companies to the huge public bureaucracies that administer the governmental services. This is the implications of this, I think, are absolutely astounding and unending. You're talking about a whole shift in class and a whole shift in race and a whole shift in the function of cities. Okay, so much for background stuff. But sometimes I do think it's important to sit back and think about what cities as a whole do. But most of the time, when we're living day-to-day in cities, we're dealing with particular kinds of problems and issues, the conglomeration of which we talk about as the urban crisis. It's clear that there is something like an urban crisis. It was discovered in 1962. The date of its discovery has nothing to do with the date of its genesis. It's simply that we have as a nation a kind of habit of discovering every once in a while some crises that have laid around for 50 years or 100 years. We certainly, every 20 or 25 years we rediscover the fact that there's poverty in the country. The same way with city stuff. It phases in and out. I want to talk, I guess, just real briefly about five areas that seem to me particularly interesting and to raise a lot of questions. I want to talk about race and work and planning and neighborhoods and organizing for justice. Those five things, real briefly. And think a little bit about where we've been with each of those things for the last 15 years, and state as briefly as I can what I think a couple of the problems and questions are that these areas have raised for us. Obviously, we could also talk about lots of other things. We could talk about housing and architecture and culture and education and media, even religion. We could talk about the economics of cities. We can talk about transportation, energy. Cities are the place where all of these things come together. And to some degree, divvying up topics like this is an exercise in artificiality. We'll do it anyway. Race. If you think about racism as it's as it appears in American cities today, you have to certainly think about the demographics of population. You have to think about the huge influx into places that were not ready for them of blacks, mostly as cheap labor from the South in the teens, 20s, and 30s, and to some degree during World War II, immediately after. You have to think about the fact that in-migration from the South is mostly stopped. You have to think about the fact that in most northern cities, that flow has been beginning to be reversed, that you run into more and more folks that are heading back down south after a generation or two of city living. That's interesting. You have to think clearly in most cities. Footnote here. Minneapolis, St. Paul will be exception to most everything I say about cities. It's a lovely suburb of Chicago, and we can get into the reality of the Twin Cities after a bit, maybe. But it is it is a little bit different. In most Midwestern and Northeastern cities, you're seeing what the Southwest has dealt with for many decades, a large influx of Spanish-speaking residents. You're seeing the dissolution of the old white ethnic communities, which defined Midwestern and Northeastern cities for a while. And you're seeing, I guess when you deal in the question of race, you're seeing a period where leadership in the black community is still struggling to redefine its reality post-civil rights movement and trying to figure out what agenda is workable for them for the next years in cities. In some sense, we can see now that the civil rights movement in its southern phase accomplished most of the things that it set out to do. That is, it opened up equal access to some of the, at least public accommodations. It somehow energized politically the rights of black folks. But Chicago, I suppose, is the one case, the one typical case of what happened to the civil rights movement when it tried to get into the urban settings. King really got his rear end handed to him, excuse the vernacular, when he came up against Daley in Chicago. And I think that that happened in terms of the civil rights movement's attempt to translate their reality into urban reality all over the place. The forms of racism in northern industrial cities, at least, and my guess is in western cities as well, were simply not the same as the forms of racism in the semi-urbanized South, which was the basis for the civil rights movement. Dr. King, when he came to Chicago in the late 60s, in 67, 66 and 67, simply could not understand what one of my colleagues writes about as the web of urban racism, where intentional personal racial animosity, which we could call prejudice, really doesn't exist, except in occasional white blue-collar communities, but where black folks nonetheless are at the bottom of the heap as a result of a whole lot of very complex impersonal forces, institutions, in other words, that simply reinforce exclusion. It is a topic that we could talk about for days, the way racism works in sophisticated urban America, because nobody intends it to work that way. Nonetheless, the conjunction of the educational system, the needs of the labor force, the functioning of the economy, the housing patterns, all and many more conspire to keep blacks where they are and have been in cities. My guess, my strong feeling is that the civil rights movement in northern cities has had little or no impact on the lives or relative deprivation of by far the majority of the black population. Time magazine a couple of years ago, following a whole lot of other lines of argument, did a cover on the black middle class. And there is some debate over the significance of that. One of my colleagues on our staff, a black man, argues that there is no such thing as the black middle class, that in fact what you're seeing is some people who are beginning to at least come to the edge of partial security, but usually by holding down two, three, or more jobs per household, and that the kind of comfort that we associate with the word middle class, whatever we mean economically by that, is simply not present even in those black communities. Well, I think that there probably is a middle class, but I think that its significance has been vastly overplayed, that all of the statistics, employment statistics and so on, argue strongly that things have not changed significantly even for upwardly mobile portion of the black community, and that they have certainly not changed at all for the masses of the black poor. As a matter of fact, what has become clearer and clearer to me is that we're dealing with a closing off of options for the black poor in the city. That we may be talking now about the presence of an economically necessary permanent underclass in the cities, much like the permanent underclass that we find in underdeveloped countries of the third world. That the talk you hear about the 50, 60, 70% unemployment rate among young black males in urban areas is not something that can be ameliorated by job training programs, education programs, all the best intentions, but that the function of that underclass economically is now locked in, and that nothing short of major structural realignment can possibly attack that problem. That is a pessimistic point of view, but I see more and more evidence for that, and we can perhaps talk about that. I am not sure that when we think about racism in cities, and here's the problem, that we yet even understand the nature and complexity of the web of urban racism and how it conspires to keep blacks and now Latinos where they are in the class and income structure of our cities, and how necessary they are for the functioning of a whole lot of other folks, like the growing service bureaucracies and the growing number of people like my students in colleges who will make their living in some way or another serving the poor. Somehow, a way must be found to activate that mass of non-white folks if we are even to approach creating a constituency for change in the area of racism. I am not hopeful about that. But nonetheless, that seems to me an important agenda that we need to deal with. We did learn some things out of the 60s and 70s in cities. Those of us who are white and who have been kicked out of any number of organizations and meetings in the black community have painfully learned that there needs to be space created for black leadership and for communities to define their own turf and their own agendas. And it may be that we might be coming toward a time when black and white, at least those whites who have learned the lessons, having been kicked out of enough stuff, might be ready again to work with black leadership on some of the justice issues that face the black community. I at least find less resistance, even among nationalist friends in Chicago, black nationalist friends, to white participation in some of the organizing and work that they're up to. That is one thing that's slightly hopeful, but I can't in all conscience talk about too much hope in that area. Well, we could go on with that for a long time. Let me just talk about work for a minute. I referred to what we're seeing in the northeastern and midwestern cities, and I would guess increasingly we will see it in other parts of the country as well, in terms of the out-migration of jobs from the cities. The bankruptcy of the near bankruptcy of New York, the problems of budget in Cleveland, the teetering on the brink of places like St. Louis and Detroit, the avoidance of that only by high gamesmanship in Chicago under the late mayor, all reflects the fleeing of the industrial job base, basically. From urban areas, and the shift from the industrial city to the mass service city. As we move to a service economy in cities, numbers of things happen. One of the things that happens is that those interested in the economy of cities concentrate more and more totally on the downtown. So that you see stuff like Renaissance Center in Detroit. You see at this point in Chicago something like $16 billion worth of stuff going into the ground, all within the few mile square area of the downtown. You see, you rarely hear economists or urban planners talking about renewal of cities in any other terms but the renewal of downtown. This reflects, I think, the shift in the workforce, the shift in the work base, the economic base, from an industrial workforce to a mass service workforce. What you're doing is you're creating a service elite center You have to pay attention to the transportation primarily between middle and upper middle class bedroom communities and that downtown area. You have to give the private sector all of the breaks that the public sector gets to build and rebuild downtown. And you're also then reclaiming the center city from the poor. Much of what we, I think, popularly talk about when we think about the decay of cities and urban crisis has to do with our dealings with downtowns in various areas. And I suppose most of what middle-class people mean by urban crisis is reflected by the you know, the just simple things like the lack of safety you feel when you're walking around downtowns in major urban areas. Part of the shift to the mass service city means the reclamation of those center city areas for the middle and upper middle class, primarily white workers and constituents, and once again, the removal of poor people from what was formerly their turf. There are things to be said for that. I mean, clearly, the teetering on the edge of financial disaster that so many cities are going through at this point needs to be addressed. You have to address tax-based questions. You have to find the money to provide the complex net of services that cities need. And you have to make room for that part of the economy that's growing. Industry is not growing. Jobs for blue-collar and non-white people are not growing. Jobs for educated middle-class service bureaucrats are. And that's what center cities increasingly are about. The major irony for me when I think about work in the city, there's so much other stuff we could talk about. The major irony is when you drive through cities, and all of you do this, and you at least you get off the expressways, and you look at neighborhoods that really do still look like Berlin after the war, that have inadequate everything from housing to playgrounds to schools to shopping strips to development projects. Nothing's happening in those neighborhoods. One of the things that cries out to me is think about all the work that could be done in those neighborhoods. There is work to be done in those neighborhoods. That exists side by side with massive unemployment. People not doing work. There is something totally insane about cities these days. That is one emblem of insanity to me. Massive unemployment next to massive, necessary work that needs to be done. What is it, we ask then, about the organization of the economic, political, social life in our cities that means that such a stark kind of contrast just slaps us in the face when we drive through cities. Some of us sometimes walk through cities too. Now, massive needs next to massive unemployment. Absolute nonsense. Agenda for the 80s. We talk about planning for a minute. This is an area that's kind of fun if you're interested in cities. One of the problems with the American planning community of technocrats, I suppose, in my view, is that they don't understand cities. There's something about the American Academy and maybe the American lifestyle, I think, still, that is basically anti-urban. And this goes to planners. Have you ever talked to planners whose major priorities were not green space, gardens, open lawns, trees, shrubs, the way things feel? I like all that stuff, but it's not necessarily city. So much of what we get that is implemented, that planners have been thinking about in cities, at least historically over the last 50 years, much of what we've gotten, hasn't worked because it's a kind of transplantation of a suburban notion, of a suburban or rural notion of how people ought to live into a milieu where it doesn't fit and where it doesn't work. the major, I suppose, one of the major explications of this point of view that I'm arguing at the moment is, you know, certainly one of my favorite books, Jane Jacobs' book on the death and life of great American cities. She argues, she has a marvelous story near the beginning of that book about some time she was spending in the north end of Boston. The north end of Boston being at that point designated a slum. She spent three wonderful days walking around the streets. There were smells, there was variety, there were people in the streets doing stuff, there was music out of windows, there was washing over. There was a sense of life in that community that was striking to her. I like that kind of neighborhood too. I also like Holden, but I like that kind of neighborhood. It's a city kind of liveliness. The streets become you know, have a public function, and the streets belong to the people was one of the old slogans from the student movement in the 60s, and they do in some urban communities, interesting places. Well, she called up her planning friends at Harvard and MIT, and they all said, "What are you doing in north end of Boston? That's a slum. The population rate is so many thousands per square mile." The income is below anything that's livable. We've got to tear that place down, and we've got planning students right now working on a new design for that area of Boston. Jacobs couldn't believe it. Here was a neighborhood that said everything that city was supposed to say about what it did for people in their lives. And the planning folk at Harvard and MIT were going to haul it down. Well, okay, that's a kind of, I'm saying planners don't love cities. Lots of planners don't love cities. And if you're going to plan for a city, you got to at least like them. Lots of examples of absolute screw-ups by planners in cities over the last 20 years, and we're still paying for them, and I'm not sure that planners even ought to be allowed in the city limits. That's my position at times.
Don't send them out in the suburbs.
Okay. Well, okay. Yeah, they've made a mess out there, too. One clear example in northern and midwestern cities, at any rate, is the total travesty of public housing. This was to be the planned solution for folks who were living in tenements and had no plumbing in some cases and so on and so on. So all of the housing stuff, right? So you look in your major, at least northern and midwestern cities at this point, and you have miles and miles of 16 and 20 story warehouses for poor people. You just transplant poor folks off the streets and out of their tenements into concrete blocks, which are constructed on the principle of the greatest square feet per dollar. The absolutely awful places to try to do family life in, and you have the kinds of large families that you're dealing with scrunched onto the 14th floor with no playground area, and you wonder why babies fall off the 14th floor when they're playing in the corridor. St. Louis, a few years ago, some of you know, I'm sure, just dynamited their largest public housing project, which had been constructed in the late, in the mid-50s as the solution to the urban housing process. Blew Pruitt-Igoe straight to the sky. So that's enough. This was wrong. Maybe that's what needs to be done. Well, I suppose one other area that you can kind of laugh more at rather than weep over the travesties that planners have wreaked on cities is the area of new towns. Awful lot of eggheadish thought went into how you develop from scratch new communities, either out in suburbia or more recently in the middle of the city. They're trying that in Chicago in a number of new towns for 80,000 is going on right south of the loop at this point on some old railroad tracks. Well, those two, for lots of fairly complex reasons, have basically failed. And I think it was just 2 months ago that HEW finally decided that no more seed money would be given to Newtown experiments. There's something there about one of the lessons there. It has, for me, has to do with the arrogance of planners, that you give up working with the social fabric that defines people where they are in cities. You just give up looking at them as potential actors dealing with their own future, and say to yourself, I can do much better for people starting from scratch. That is, I think, the ultimate sort of imperial technocratic mindset. And we have paid for it in our cities. The problems in planning are legion. They have to do with private rights versus public good, kinds of stuff we were talking about last night. They have to do with participation on the part of folks versus the need for the kinds of expertise that is necessary in the planning process. It has to do with the whole question around localism versus regionalism. Sure, some things clearly need to be handled in a city like Chicago, not in 350 separate political units, which is what our town has, counting its suburban ring, but need to be dealt with on one, you know, air from South Chicago does blow over the suburbs. And somehow there has to be a way to regionalize our thinking about some questions while localizing and democratizing our thinking about some other questions in cities, right? That's a tough one. Let me think for just a minute out loud about neighborhoods, which I think are the lifeblood of cities. And some interesting things have been happening in neighborhoods in cities over the last decade. As a matter of fact, I would argue, I think, that the sense of urban activism that came out of the 60s has been translated in the 70s into a sense of neighborhood activism. And that your major and most interesting kinds of movements, politically insurgent and participatory movements in cities have been centered on the notion of neighborhood, which I think is not at all a bad place to center it. Saul Alinsky and others pioneered a notion of empowering powerless communities that still lives on in powerful kinds of ways in cities all across the country. We learned a lot from particularly the Black, but also to some degree the Latino community, as they began to talk about local control of schools, of police, of various kinds of functions, so that a sense that you can't fight City Hall, or that somehow whatever City Hall decides is going to be anti-you, where you're living, really has generated a kind of interesting and, I think, hopeful set of reactions as neighborhoods start to get their stuff together. There are problems in thinking about neighborhoods at this point and what's happening to them. Part of it, I've talked informally with some of you about what you see going on in your towns in the Northwest and West, as well as what we see out East. The whole re-entry of the middle and upper middle class into the city as the energy crunch hits, as cars become more and more insane, and more first young but now older people as well are moving back into city neighborhoods. The nice term for that I just love is gentrification, the return of the landed gentry into city neighborhoods, is again a two-edged sword. It helps tax base. It saves some marvelous old structures. It pumps some kinds of life back into the city, but at the same time, seems to be a running theme here. Who pays for that? The poor, mostly. They are the ones whose neighborhoods are being gentrified and regentrified. They are the ones who get kicked around like they were with urban renewal in the late 50s. Trouble there. One other area that I think needs some work on in the 1980s in the area of neighborhood organization is a problem that I'm seeing arising in lots of neighborhoods, and that is the shift from community organization to community development. Some of the some of the community organizations, which are formulated on the premise that you battle outside forces, whether city hall or insurance companies that redline your area, all of those kinds of forces, and you mobilize people to do that, then begin to say to themselves, now listen, why can't we do a whole lot of stuff for ourselves in this community? How can we think constructively about building our neighborhood? So they begin to think about the notion of development, economic development, community development. That spawns a different kind of organization. One of the problems, and it's a kind of nitty-gritty one, but it's one that I work with all the time, so at least it's important to me, is that when you start thinking about economic development and rebuilding neighborhoods with the resources that are there in the neighborhood and whatever you can hustle from outside, you're almost inevitably going to create another local elite, another set of experts that somehow robs the lifeblood of participation that this old community organization had. One of the, you know, those of you who've seen any Alinsky groups at work know that one of the hugely attractive or frightening, depending on your point of view, things about them is that ordinary folks, wonderfully frumpy looking men and women who don't look like three-piece suited folks, run up against HUD officials and bankers and just give them hell, and it's wonderful. And it builds in them a sense of that they can do it, you know, that they're folks that have something to say and that they can make themselves heard. It's more difficult to translate for ordinary people the tasks that need to be done in a development arena. And in neighborhoods that I know about, in five or six cities anyway, that's a real question for me these days. How do you participate in development? Finally, just a word or two about justice work, and I think it's implied in all the stuff that I've been saying this morning. The simple era where you know what's right and you go out and you do it, you either witness for it or you organize for it or you're pretty sure where you're going. Gone, totally gone. One way to read the history of the civil rights movement, various other kinds of things, and those of us who came out of those movements, is that gradually as we peeled away what it is we were fighting against and for, the thing got incredibly complex. Difficult to see anything that is pure to do anymore. One of the things that our students constantly run up against, they want to come into the city to do good, to help. We get some of those kind. That's probably the same kind of people go to seminary, right? One of the hardest lessons they have to learn is that you can't keep your hands clean. That you gotta get down in there in the dirt and mess around in some stuff that has some negative consequences. That there is no one obvious right good thing to do in the city anymore. And that anything you do in the city will reverberate out toward the edges of the web of the city and have some negative consequences for some other grouping. That is a tough lesson for people who want to do ethics or to act the good out in their life. That's a tough lesson to learn. You can't keep your hands clean. Issues are complex, institutions are complex, the option to opt out entirely seems to me to be wrong on a number of scores, not the least of which is that you can't opt out entirely. No matter what you do, you're going to be affecting stuff, so you might as well try to do it consciously. So the problems for activists these days are sort of combining a sense of sophistication, which is absolutely necessary about how cities work, for instance, with still an ability to act. Sophistication and complication can be incredibly immobilizing. The more you know about something, the more complex it gets, the harder it is to act. But the more you act out of a simple-minded kind of notion of what needs to be done, the more you are probably unconsciously going to screw things up. Let me stand there.
I guess we maybe have time for a question. Well, it's getting pretty close to lunchtime. I went farther than I wanted to. Yes.
What effect have you noticed had the minimum wage laws had on this mass of unemployed male blacks, young male blacks?
Oh, I don't know. You can argue that one. Probably, my guess is that some more unskilled members of the workforce would maybe be hired were minimum wage laws not there. But I don't see it as a major factor. I think that the question of unemployment in cities is a much more radically structural question than whether or not minimum wage laws exist. I mean, certainly you hear that from business people a lot, that if I didn't have to pay minimum wage, I could hire some of these guys off the street to do some stuff.
Well, the labor unions say it is such a wonderful thing, the laws are. I just wonder.
You know, you think about, I guess I think that my own view is that that's a fairly irrelevant question, pro or con, although I recognize that it's at the top of the legislative debate, both nationally and at some state levels continually. You know, one of the reasons it's irrelevant is that if you look at the Labor Department statistics on what constitutes a survival level of income in cities at this point, the figure is something like 10 to 11,000 for a family of four. And a minimally moderate standard of living is something like 15 or 16,000 for a family of four. So whether or not someone gets the minimum wage really doesn't bring them even close to the minimal survival wage, at least as defined by the feds in this era of inflation. So I'm not sure.
Jody, why do you think there is this subclass? Not employable people is locked in. What's their function? Why are they? What's the function that keeps them in the structure?
That's a complicated thing. Let me just say a couple of things about it. I think that partly they serve well as clients and recipients. Okay. That they do have a function in the society, and they're there to be served by people like us who have jobs serving them. Partly the structure of work in our shift to the service economy is predicated on skills levels and educational attainments that are impossible to get in inner city public schools. So there's a meshing of training inadequacies and job market needs. Partly, you know, the radical diminishment of unskilled labor, the need for you just don't need unskilled labor anymore. And that used to be the first rung of the ladder for immigrant groups entering the economic mainstream. I mean, people would come over, do unskilled labor for a while, get apprenticed to a skilled a semi-skilled position, and gradually work up. But they needed that first step, that first area of unskilled work where they could get their foot on the ladder. Well, that's precisely the area of the economy that doesn't exist anymore, basically. I mean, there just aren't that many jobs for unskilled folk. And therefore, the normal route in that other ethnic and immigrant groups have used is closed off for lots of folks. So they find themselves in an urbanized situation in a very different economic setting than the older immigrant groups did.
So you're saying they're locked up, they're excluded.
Yeah.
By the structure.
Yeah.
If this black sector feels or knows that they're excluded, what's to prevent another revolution, uprising of civil rights, violence and so on. I mean, is this a cyclic thing that we're going to see then?
Well, I think it's clearly a tinderbox, but I'm not sure how close to explosion it is at any given time. I mean, there are an awful lot of mechanisms used to keep this class dependent and docile. Our one of our best friends is a mother of 13 kids and a grandmother of 22, who functions as the sort of in a poor black community as the sort of center of community life on a very survival kind of level, you know, and she lives full 24-hour days without organizing that community to rebel, so that there's a sense in which the attention to day-to-day survival, you know, is not the basis out of which you would expect a rebellion to be birthed. You know, you just got to pay too much attention to what you do after the third week when the welfare check gets cut off. How you get your next meal? How do you get kid number four out of the jail that you got picked up and thrown into last night? I mean, it's just an endless, endless stream of survival questions, and that's not necessarily fertile ground for explosion.
You're not a Marxist.
Oh, I think I am in some ways, but Marx, you know, did not expect explosion out of the lumpen proletariat.
What kind of massive things do you see as a remedy? You mentioned along the way that something massive would have to happen to jar them out of the situation.
Boy, I don't know.
Tough question.
Yeah. Maybe we ought to toss that one around more tomorrow. As I think about what we need to do in the next 80s, in the next decade, thinking about the cities, maybe we can look at that. If I promise not to talk as long tomorrow, we're going to have some more time to throw some possible solutions in.
Joey, there sounds to me to be some like self-fulfilling prophecies in a lot of what you say. I'm not sure how to break out of that, but the idea that the poor will always have with us, the hardcore unemployed we will always have with us, could generate some elements of complacency, which if changed probably radically somehow, I don't know exactly how, might spell different futures for a lot of people. I think last night you were talking about the inadequacy or the failure of job training programs. Sometimes I wonder if we don't generalize so much that we fail to understand or recognize that there are individuals that probably do go through those kinds of things, who do survive and who do develop different futures for themselves. But the self-fulfilling prophecy is such an insidious thing. And I wonder if people, especially like you, who have an overview, don't need to also be that in mind. Okay, maybe that's true, but maybe it's not true.
Yeah, I mean, when I'm talking in the kinds of generalities I've been using this morning, I'm not certainly ruling out exceptions, lots of them, to those generalities. But I do think it's necessary to be as coldly realistic and analytical as we can be about what's going on in the cities. I think the permanent underclass in the cities is a fairly new phenomenon. I would not have talked much about it 8 years ago. I wouldn't have seen it as a permanent, structurally necessary for the economy thing in cities. I think that lots of things are changing so rapidly in the urban scene that it's now necessary to talk about that as a locked-in structural phenomenon in the cities. Now, that doesn't mean you don't work on it. It doesn't mean you resign to it. It just means that's what I think the description of it is. So I don't think we're contradicting each other. Let's go eat. Thank you.